Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network. Since I started doing All Marine Radio 3 years ago, starting next week, one of the favorite things that I've done or do are things that we call battlefield studies. And so we're gonna do one of those today, and we're going to talk about Contian. You know, the subject of near-peer war or peer-to-peer war comes up now, you know, very often in the news and the stuff you read about the military, and if you look through history, the last time we fought anything close to somebody that would locate close with and come and try to put our heads on a stick was in the 1967-68 time frame, and the epicenter of that was a place called Contian. And so I'm privileged to be joined today by a Marine who retired as a Marine Corps gunner. He's one of the first ones when General Gray brought that program back. His name is Tim Galinas. So, Tim, first of all, thanks for doing that. Am I pronouncing your last name right?
Yeah.
All right. So, Tim, we got to find out about you, all right, before we talk about all the rest of this stuff. First of all, born and raised where?
Born and raised in Woonsocket, Rhode Island.
All right. How does the Marine Corps get on your radar?
Well, 1965, Vietnam was going, and that didn't play a big part in my enlistment in the Marine Corps. What did was I was sitting in an algebra class, and somebody gave me a hard time, so I got up and dropped the guy, and that was it for that. I got expelled, so on my way home, I walked by the post office, saw the sign, went in and talked to the recruiter. Then I went to the local speed shop where a lot of my friends hung out. I got four other guys. We went down and came into the buddy program. And I guess the rest is history. Went to boot camp at Parris Island in 1965. Graduated from boot camp, went to infantry training regiment, ITR, and then Camp Lejeune. And then from Camp Lejeune, I got orders to Vietnam. I went to Camp Pendleton for staging battalion. And staging battalion back then, it was pretty much non-live fire. So I'm not so sure it gave you the tools you needed to cross the line of departure and meet what nobody knew what we were going to face out there.
Right. Hey, Tim, let me ask you. School of Infantry, when does School of Infantry go into business? All right, before he answers that question, here's a programming note. All the maps that we talk about are on the website right now. So we obviously recorded this interview. But if you go to All Marine Radio, right, you go to the podcast page, you can go there now. Right. If you click on Battlefield Study, a PFC at Contian in Quezon, Gunner Tim Galinas, USMC retired, picture of Gunner Galinas there, and then you'll see a whole series of pictures, right, of Contian, the laydown of Contian. It start the map start of where it was in Vietnam. Right, so they run 1 through 8 or 9 from general to the Pacific, right? So what so where it is in Vietnam, what the expanse of really the Leatherneck Square, which stretched from the Pacific Ocean or Highway 1 out towards the rock pile. And so it shows you that. There's a map that shows Leatherneck Square, right? Dong Ha, Gio Linh, Contian, Cam Lo, and then an aerial image of Contian. And then there's a really cool depiction. It's a hand drawn. And what it does is it shows there's 1, 2, 3 hills that comprise the base at Kantian. And then it shows the laydown of it. And so you get to see where, you know, the LZ was, where the artillery was, where the different OPs were, where the CP was. So all that's on it. And then there's a map. Map number 6 has the image of Kantian Fire Base and the diagram side by side. So it's pretty cool. So you can see the two hilltops that are the furthest north that comprise the company positions. You see another hilltop south of that and on the eastern side of the kind of complex, and then everything to the west of that, left on the picture, is all the support stuff, right? The LZs, where the 81s were, where the 105s were, so all that. So it's a pretty cool little laydown. And then you get to see some of the areas that were Operations Hickory, Lam Song, Belt Tight, Bow Charger all took place, and kind of the scheme maneuver for that. You get to see the battles that took place, where the North Vietnamese came from, where they went. And then the last map is pretty cool. I talked about it last week, but it's the 3rd Marine Division Areas of Operation and Strong Point Obstacle System, January 1968 is when the snapshot's taken. So what you see is all the different fire bases, right? All the different bases that were built in the northern end of South Vietnam, known as I Corps, and then you see where Kantian is. You also see the what's called the trace, which is the cleared trace that Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, no relation, had cleared. So all those maps are there. And in the next, I don't know, hour or two, what I'll do is if you click on the map on the page, it'll take you to a larger version of the map. So for those of you mapophiles like me, you can check it out. But it helps you follow along and understand, you know, as he bounced around as a PFC, his story. So part of the beauty of these battlefield studies, in my opinion, is those maps that help what he's saying come alive for you visually, which I hopefully will lead to a deeper understanding as Marines, young Marine leaders listen to this that makes them better, which is the whole point of this. So with all of that said, we go back to regularly scheduled programming, Gunner Tim Galinas in Battlefield Study, a PFC at Kantian and Quezon, courtesy of your friends here at All Marine Radio on the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
When I was a gunner, we formed the 1st School of Infantry West out of Camp Pendleton.
All right, what year about?
Oh, that was in, I think, the 80s.
Okay, all right. So that unit that you went to was an ad hoc unit stood up to get guys ready to deploy to Vietnam?
What is that, the School of Infantry?
Well, no, not the School of Infantry, but the school you went to as a PFC.
Oh, so you mean Staging Battalion?
Exactly.
Yeah, Staging Battalion was something everybody had to go through at Camp Pendleton before you went to Vietnam. It was, I think, 3 weeks of training. You did a lot of hiking, and you did a lot of lane training, booby traps. Had a couple of Vietnamese villages out there, and then from there, once you completed Staging Battalion, you went to El Toro, got on a plane, and you flew to Okinawa, Camp Hansen.
Got it.
And then from Hansen, you got processed, and we flew into Da Nang, and then from Da Nang, we got assigned different units. I got assigned to 1-9 with a group of Marines. So we hung out there and caught a flight up to Dong Ha. We flew up to Dong Ha, and interesting story about Dong Ha. We landed in Dong Ha, and they put us on a truck. We drove us to the rear area of 1-9, and there was a formation of sea bags outside with record books on them. Well, that's exactly what we had. We had our sea bags, and we had a record book. So we got off the truck and put our sea bags right on the end of that formation, and our first sergeant came out of the strong back tent, and he said, what are you guys doing? And we said, well, we're putting our sea bags on the end of that formation. He goes, they don't go there. Your sea bags go over there. These guys just got killed in the last battle. And then we're all sitting there looking at us saying, wow.
How many sea bags?
Oh, God, there must have been 25 or 30.
All right. So welcome to Vietnam. Welcome to 1-9.
And then we did the check-in thing, and once we finished the check-in thing, we got trucked back to the airport within a couple of days because we were going up to Quezon. So we went up to Quezon and met the platoon sergeant, met a few other guys in the unit, and within 2 weeks we were on a routine patrol, and that started the battle for 861-881. It started out of a routine patrol. We weren't expected to make that kind of contact. And that battle raged on for a couple of days. And the thing I'll never forget about that battle is the length of time we carried our dead. I mean, you carried dead Marines until they turned into mush.
Wow.
It was unbelievable. I can remember sitting down, and some of these guys, I didn't even know. I just joined the unit. And the thing about Vietnam was, when these kids go to combat today, they're pretty much set up for success. I mean, they go out there as an entire unit. You know everybody in your company, and if you happen to be a turd, then everybody in the battalion knows you, at least you know somebody. And out there, you didn't know anybody at first. I mean, you had to make friends, and you had to make them fast. And I'm carrying a body, and I'm looking at this body at the end of 2 or 3 days, it's turning into mush. You're looking at somebody's brother, somebody's uncle, somebody's father, and back then when you're 18, it just doesn't hit you until, like, years later. You sit down and say, God almighty, what the hell are we doing out there? But anyway, we ended up fighting our way up to the top of 861, and it was dark when we got up there, so we dug in. And it was one of those patrols, I didn't bring an E-tool, and we started taking incoming, so I'm trying to dig a quick skirmish trench with a canteen cup and a K-bar. So I end up getting below ground, and everybody, when you dropped your body off that night, when you got up there, you put all the dead in one spot, and then the wounded in another spot. And then the corpsmen were over there with the wounded, trying to work them until daylight so we could get a medevac in.
Wow.
So right, next morning we end up packing out an LZ, and we put the wounded on him, and then we kept the dead out there for a little bit, because every time you called the helicopter in, the enemy threw everything he had at you. So you ended up keeping the dead because they didn't want to risk a helicopter going in if they didn't have to.
All right, now, here's what, Tim, what I want to do is I want to hit pause and talk about Con Tien and your Vietnam experience. I just want to give everybody kind of a thumbnail sketch of your career. You come back to Vietnam. Where do you go? What do? Take us through your career in the Marine Corps.
Oh, okay. I came back from, I finished my second tour in Vietnam in 1968. And I came back. I got out of the Marine Corps. I worked construction for a couple of years. We joined a Special Forces Reserve unit out of Providence, Rhode Island. A couple of years later, I came back on active duty in 1974, and I picked up Meritorious Sergeant. And then I knew I was behind my peers, so I went to the drill field. I did a tour at Parris Island as a DI in their battalion. And then from there, I took over barracks, as a barracks gunny, NAS Lamar, with the guy by the name of Colonel Bathurst. And, you know?
I've had him on a couple times. He's he talks about arriving at Lemoore and what it was like and how he turned it around. I mean his whole story is an incredible story. I love when he says, you know, he gets a letter from headquarters Marine Corps that says, "You're the only lieutenant colonel in the Marine Corps with a high school education. We'd appreciate it if you, in the next 3 years, if you got a college degree." And, I said, "I'd have framed that thing. I'd have blown that thing up and framed it for everybody." And, no, but his story's amazing. And he's still doing work with, the young Marines in Illinois and still doing great things.
Yeah, let me tell you, Bathurst is probably hands down one of the smartest guys I think I've ever met. He sat down and wrote my warrant officer package on a legal yellow paper and started writing. I was sitting in the corner. He started writing, double spaced, went through 3 or 4 pages of paper. They typed it, came back, he made a couple of corrections, sent it in. I picked up warrant officer.
Wow.
I mean, the guy was, extremely smart. We took the Paris on a half marathon, and then we took him on a 17-mile run for the tune-up. It was an interesting place to be, Lemoore.
Right. No. He talks about what you all inherited. And how you turned it around and the lessons that, he said, you know, Marines are Marines. And if you treat them like Marines, they'll respond like Marines. And, he said that's exactly what we did, and it took us a little bit of time to get some of them out of there. And then once we did, and we had good leaders and we started treating them like Marines, he said they acted like Marines. He said it wound up being a great unit.
Yeah. And you know, it's true. A lot of what he says has a lot to do with instilling discipline. You don't have to do a lot of yelling and screaming, but what you do is you set standards, you set reasonable standards, and you enforce the standard. It's that simple. And I think maybe today we're not, you know, enforcing the standard.
All right. Well, you're going to come back and talk about, you're going to do a segment on discipline with us maybe next week. And General Halleck, I'll record something with him in a couple of days, or tomorrow I think I record something with him. So it's been the interview I did with Gerald Van Riper has been incredibly received by the people that have listened to it and shared it. And so this is going to form an incredible library for young leaders about how you do it, because a lot of them, I don't think, And I think you could make the statement, I mean, we went through it after Vietnam. People forget why we are the way we are, why we do business the way we do business, and you get these salty dogs come back and say, yeah, that's all chicken shit. And it takes professionals that have been in the Marine Corps that have seen this through cycle after cycle after cycle to look at young salty dogs and say, hey, shut up and color. This is how we do it. We do it this way for a reason. We didn't get to be like this for no reason. We do it like this for a reason. And so I think these interviews are awesome, and I'm excited, Tim, that you're going to do one too.
Yeah, I think we have a lot of, liberals running around both in and out of the military. And, I had an incident, a couple of years ago. I had a nice guy with his wife. He came up to me and thanked me for my service, something you didn't get during the Vietnam War. Nobody thanked you for anything. But anyway, this guy came up and thanked me for my service, and then he says to me, he says, what do the Marines think about as they're getting ready to go to war? And I said, you know, I think when they're here stateside, they're thinking about the family, getting everything ready for their family so that when they deploy, their wife and their kids are, you know, going to be taken care of. I said, but once they get over there on the enemy side of the line of departure, I said, they're thinking about the mission, and they're thinking about, you know, action at the objective, action on enemy contact, all of those things that are important. But I said, let me tell you what they're not thinking of. They're not thinking of the First Amendment. They're not thinking of the fact that they're out there so that football players can take a knee during the national anthem. They're not thinking of that. Let me tell you, when I was in boot camp, and I did, and the DI was stomping a mud hole in my ass and walking it dry. At no time did I ever sit there or lay there thinking, you know, I'm out here and my brother and sister can run into a crowded theater and holler fire because I'm out here defending the First Amendment. That is a bunch of crap. And I have so many people that think that. They think that you're out there fighting for them so they can run around and say and do whatever the hell they want. You cross the line of departure because there's people on the enemy side of the line of departure that need killing, and you're going out there to do to kill them. That's why you cross the line of departure.
I had a guy.
At least me. That's the way I look at it.
I had a guy that thanked me for, and I knew him, and I can't remember. I think I came back from my third deployment, and he said, thank you for fighting for my freedom. I said, I'm not fighting for your freedom. And he says, what? He says, what do you mean? And I said, like, is your freedom at risk right now? Like, your freedom's not at risk, you know? He said, well, why are you fighting? I said, because I'm a Marine. And the commandant says, this is where we're going, and these people need to be killed. And he looked at me and said, that's why you're fighting?
Yeah. And you know what really irritates me? When you see a commentator during the football season, and he says that there's a football player who's got a buddy that was in the Navy SEALs, and he said that he went to Iraq so this nut could take a knee. That is nothing but a bunch of bull. Nobody crosses the line of departure thinking in the back of their mind, I'm out here so people back in the States can, Black Lives Matter and the Occupy Wall Street guys and everybody else can burn city blocks down. You don't cross the line of departure for that. You cross the line of departure because the bad guys out there doing bad things that need killing, and you're going to go out there and make sure that the right guy gets killed. That's why you cross the line of departure.
All right.
Period.
All right, we'll come back to that next week. Now, I want you to walk me through your career. Bathurst gets you into the, at the time, it's a warrant officer program, yes? Or is it the gunner? Or has the gunner program come back?
It wasn't the gunner program yet. I was an O3, and that year when I put in for it, there wasn't much open for an infantry guy. So I put in for 9925, was a ranked officer, and they had a new MOS. NBC officer, didn't even know what it was. So I put in for that. I didn't. But anyway, the board called my boss, which was Bathurst, and they said, ask this guy if he wants to be an NBC officer. So Colonel Bathurst says, yeah, he does, do it. So then he calls me and he goes, hey, the board just called. And he said, they got openings in the 5702 field. So I told him you would be interested. So still didn't know anything definite because the board wasn't out. Then the board came out. I had got selected. There was 10 guys got selected. 9 of us were right off the drill field. So there was 9 DIs down there and 1 5711 in the NBC officers class. So, and then once I got in there, I worked my bolt, and then General Gray came down to School of Infantry, and he talked to Gunner Bolton. He was the last 0302 gunner,
right.
And he was getting ready to move up to the Squad Leaders Academy, and they brought me in to take his place. So then General Gray was talking about bringing back the gunner program.
Now,
Gunner was in the talking stage, and they said, is this the right guy to take your place? And Bolton said, yeah, he is. So I took his place, and then the wheels started spinning, and they brought the gunner program back, and I went back to IOC to meet the first class of gunners, and then I did a couple of tours in 3-5, 1-1, and 1-7, and I just progressed on up.
Hold on.
Marines, I mean, I enjoyed every single day of it.
Let me ask you about, did you know General Gray?
I didn't know him well. I met him numerous times. I met him out here during an exercise where we gave him a brief. It was just before General Webb had resigned, so he was on a West Coast swing. So we met and talked to him then, and then I met him again when he came out to SOI West to, and it wasn't, he talked about the GAR program and other things that they were talking about, the SOI West coming online and writing the POIs and how we were going to structure it and other things. And, he had a guy named Patty Collins was his kind
right,
of his,
right.
his sledgehammer. And, and anyway, my career went on. I was a coyote out at the TPCG. I did the coyote from 96 to 2000. I did like 40 caches. Met a lot of people, had a lot of fun. And then I retired. And then the Iraq War came on. And
so what year? What year? What year did you retire?
I retired in 2000.
Okay, all right. And then what were you doing when the war started?
I was working at the local high school as kind of a bouncer. Actually, I was a campus supervisor, but it was kind of more like a bouncer when you had to break up the fights.
All right, so you're doing that, and then you come back on active duty, yes?
Yep, I come. The Iraq War looked like it was going to spin, so I ran into a couple of Marines on a base that knew me, and they said, "Hey, we don't have a gunner," so. I said, I'll see what I can do. So we started the ball rolling, and then I got a call from General Mattis, and he and I spoke, and I assured him I hadn't gotten all fat and knobby on him. And so he said, you got to hear from me soon.
And you know, and you know General Mattis from 7th Marines, yes?
Yeah, I know General Mattis from 7th Marines, just an unbelievable guy. No nonsense guy, cares about the troops, but he's probably, I know one thing, he's not a guy you want to cross, and good guy.
So what do you do? So you come back on active duty, and what do?
I go to 3rd LAR, and I meet the folks in 3rd LAR. The CO was Lieutenant Colonel Clarity, great guy. Good people, and I get my marching orders from General Clarity. We had to train machine gunners, mortarmen, rocket guys, and we had a bunch of stuff that needed to get done. And he wanted to compete in the Division Cruise Air Weapons Competition, and I said, "Okay, I'll make it happen," and started working 5-6 days a week. Until we finally deployed. And those Marines were fantastic. Nobody knew what they were facing in Iraq. And we pulled into LSA 7, stayed there till a force was assembled, and then we LD'd, and those kids were fearless. Nobody knew, they heard all the horror stories about the Republican Guard and those Marines in 3rd LAR and other Marines. I mean, they were just fearless. They did a fantastic job. But I just had a bad feeling when I left that war was not going to end. I don't know what it was. I came back. I was the guest speaker at their ball before I retired again. I said, this war's got legs. It's not going to end. And I knew it wasn't going to be good.
Really?
Your
spidey sense told you that it was it wasn't going to end like it wasn't going to be like people had been. We're going to have the parade in Baghdad. We're going to bring these guys, these expatriates, back from the United States. We're going to give them a few classes on democracy and let them have at it. You didn't buy that?
Nope. I just, one of the things I thought. We had learned in Vietnam was that if you stay in a place long enough, the enemy figures you out. I mean, it's simple. He's going to figure you out, and he's going to start tunneling in. So if you don't want to deal with tunnels, or you don't want to fight a war, you're probably not going to win. You need to land the landing force and then backload them, end it, and get out of there, and don't stick around. You know. The biggest difference I can tell you between Vietnam and Iraq is this. I can go to Vietnam tomorrow. I can take my wife, my kids and my grandkids, I can go up to the DMZ. I can sit across the table from a 71-year-old guy that I hunted like a dog and hunted me like a dog, and I'll be treated with respect. My family will be safe. You'll never do that in Iran. You'll never do that in Iraq. You'll never do that in Afghanistan. You'll never do that in the Middle East. Those people hate us. They'll always hate us. So, I don't know.
Wow.
And I may be wrong. And there's people that listen to this saying, you know, that guy's a wacko. You know, that's fine and dandy. But I just think the Middle East is, I don't think it's a winner.
All right. Talk to us about, so you get out of the Marine Corps, you retire a second time, you get out a second time. What year is that?
I got out in 04, and then I got hired on to the job I'm doing right now.
Okay, and what is that? What are you doing right now?
Range development aboard 29 POMs. We build and maintain live fire ranges for the Marines. The ITS program, March, Yuma folks that come out here to train, and we try to make sure that they have sufficient targets that supports their scenarios, and or if we have to build something, we you know, get a requirement from the unit, validate the requirement, and then try to go to guns, get the funding, and build what we need to build to support the ongoing battle going on in Iraq and Afghanistan. Because when I started working, we were still out in Iraq today,
right.
But we were still out there, so we had to keep retooling, because every so many, you know, months, somebody would come back from Iraq and saying, okay, this is happening out there now, we need to create this capability. And then in Afghanistan, we need to create this capability, and we would get out there and try to build it so that the units would have a place to train to get ready before they deploy back into theater.
I will say this, if you haven't been to 29 Palms in the last, well, easily 17 years, but the training facilities there now are unbelievable. When we went to Afghanistan in 2010, the training that Marines did before going over there, the villages that they could cordon and surge, that they could conduct operations either in or adjacent to, in some scenarios, the actors and the role players that they had, I mean, were absolutely positively amazing. And, at other areas, you know, the lane training that got set up, the quality of the instructors there, all were veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. If you haven't been near that stuff, as a Marine, it would blow you away, the quality of training and the training opportunities that Marines have to get ready before going someplace is pretty amazing. So, Tim, congratulations to you and all your crew out there. I mean, it's an amazing facility, honestly.
Yeah, and I think the thing you got to keep in mind about 29 POMs is we do combined arms here in the full spectrum. In the full spectrum of combined arms is direct, indirect, rotary wing, fixed wing, CAS, and maneuver on the same target at the same time. And that's probably the biggest thing we do out here, where units, as they're closing on the objective, they come within artillery range, they lift that agency, now they've got mortars firing, and they come within mid-safe of the mortar, they lift that agency, all the while the maneuver is still pushing until they get to a dismount point. And it's something that it takes a lot of work to put the package together, to, you know, to pull this off.
Right.
So, and that's what we're still doing out here today, in addition to trying to transition into a little bit of force on force.
All right. Now, I want to, speaking of transitioning, I want to transition and go back to, I want to go back to Kantian. All right, so you talked about you're at Camp Pendleton, you're going to go to Vietnam. Describe the experience. How big of a group are you in when you go to, what did you say, El Toro, and fly out of El Toro, headed west towards Vietnam? How big of a group is it?
Our replacement draft was, I think, 250 guys. So we flew into Vietnam, and everybody got their assignments. I went to, as I said earlier, 1-9. We did the 861, 881 thing. Then we came back.
So, okay, so, I want slow down for me a second. So, you fly in, and you fly into Dong Ha, and then, so you join 1-9, which company, and where do you join them?
I joined, when I got there first, I joined Bravo Company, but Bravo Company was forward deployed to Quezon.
Okay.
So after I got to, Bravo Company, we did the 861 piece.
Okay. Hold on. I apologize for interrupting you. So, so what month and what year do you join them?
I think it was March or April. I think it was March or April of 67.
Got it. Okay. All right. So,
I joined 1-9, and then I get up to, Quezon, check in up there. There was no siege. There was incoming periodically, but the siege obviously didn't really take effect till 1968.
Right.
And we went out on this routine patrol, and we ended up stumbling into a larger force, and that started the battle for the hill battles.
Okay.
And then, and what's ironic about that battle that I often think about is I met the platoon sergeant. They called him Papa, Sergeant Papa. And nice guy, great guy, and I was the new guy. So because I was the new guy in the platoon, I was kind of on this medevac beam. If there was a casualty had to be dragged or hauled, I was the guy that would end up going over there. So during the early stages of rehearsals and stuff, I was kind of on one of the medevac teams. So we had made contact, going up this one finger toward 861, and I heard a buddy of mine, Larry Nez, how he was throwing a grenade out, and then a tremendous volume of fire. And then as I'm crawling up, I hear they want a medevac team up. So I start crawling up to go and get whatever casualty was up there. And as I get to where the casualty is, it's this Sergeant Papa I had just met.
Wow.
Like the day before. I just met him. And I said, God almighty. I mean, it happened so fast. And then we put his body in a poncho and dragged it back, and we carried him for days. And it was difficult to carry him because he was almost cut in half. So the spine was the only thing holding him together. I mean, it was...
And Tim, how old are you when you get to Vietnam?
I'm 18.
You're 18.
I'm 18.
Right.
I'm 18. And then I'm in a position after I come back and lay the body down behind me. We assume our position, you know, to kind of help out in the battle because we're getting hit from an opposite piece of terrain. And over the radio... The radio operator says to the CO, he says, we had an O&E bird dog up there. Because back then, when you called an airstrike, and an O&E bird dog would show up, but it would kind of help you manage the airstrike.
Right.
And he comes over the net, and the radio operator said, sir, he said, we're surrounded. They're like ants everywhere. And I said, oh, my God, man, this is going to be a long day. And then we just battled on. Well, I forgot to tell you, we had just transitioned from the M14 to the M16.
Right.
So we had this rifle that was malfunctioning constantly. Mine jammed several times, just zeroing it up at Quezon.
Up at the base.
So now we have guys firing rifles that break they're jamming it. And in the original M16, it didn't have a forward assist on it.
Right.
So anytime you got a malfunction, you had to break the weapon down. Break out a cleaner rod and knock the round out of the chamber and then assemble your weapon and check your magazine and load it and try to fire it again. I mean, and they were jamming time after time after time. And it was frustrating. But at the time, it never even dawned on me that they gave us a bad rifle. I mean, it didn't sink in until a couple months later. You know, and I said, God almighty. I mean, That's something that would never happen today. I mean, if you had a General Mattis or a General Kelly or a General Conway or anybody, and the Marine said, hey, I got a rifle that just won't shoot, that would be it. I mean, that would stop everything. That would stop everything. Things would start happening to where that rifle would go, and it would go fast. It would not happen. They would have brought back the 14th.
No,
and everybody wanted the back. Everybody. Everybody to a man wanted the M14 back. They didn't care about the weight. That M14 was bulletproof. And you know what's ironic? We were fighting against the AK-47 back then. We're still fighting against it.
Yeah, no kidding. The same way would you... In fact, it's interesting. Reading about, you know, the fighting around Contien, you hear RPG-2, you read AK-47, right? It's all the same... You know, the same, you know, stock weapons, you know, they obviously advanced the ordnance pieces on the RPG and whatnot, but, yeah, you're right. What about, hey, Tim, what, can you describe, in this conversation about near peer or peer to peer war, can you describe, how the NVA attacked, you know, how the NVA attacked you guys?
The NVA had a unique ability to draw you in, and then they had the ability to surround you. And once they surrounded you, they would start picking you off by squads. I mean, you would start taking casualties. They would start picking you apart. And the problem was, a lot of times, you had a canopy, so you couldn't push your 60 mortars out to do direct lay, direct alignment on them. I mean, it just wouldn't work. Because you had a single or a double canopy. If you didn't have a canopy, then you could push your mortars out and get fires on them. But as soon as they made contact, the mortars followed, the rockets followed, the artillery followed. I mean, the North Vietnamese were good fighters.
And they used combined arms just like we would. And I was told up there that All their artillery, all their mortars always sat on the backside on the reverse slope of hills because of our ability to do counter battery, our ability to do aviation ordnance, and which made them really, really difficult to do that stuff against.
Yeah, they did. And the other thing they did for our strong point plan up off the DMZ with Contien and Jiu Lin, is they had artillery pieces dug into these hills with trees covering them. And they were mounted on a track. And they pull the trees away, Wheeler's got out and fire five or six rounds into the middle of Contien or Jiu Lin, and then wheel this thing back in. And we had sent recon out there to find them. We sent everybody out there to find them. And then finally, they found this 152 piece of arty out there, and we ended up sending a unit out there to get it. And not only did they find that, but they found it in an underground hospital up there, dug in, right into the side of a mountain, with brand new medical supplies, some of them from the United States.
Gotta love that. Okay, talk to me about so the experience of a new Marine. And you're operating in the mountains, initially in the vicinity of Khe Sanh. Can you describe to people what it was like to, now were you wearing both helmets and flak jackets at the time? Can you describe the weather? Can you describe the terrain? Was it mountain?
Yeah.
You say hills, but I look at that on a map and it looks like mountains to me.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's constant. A lot of it was constant cross compartment. And the other thing about the flak and the helmet, we had the old helmets,
right.
And we had the flak jackets with the plates in them, the fiberglass plates in them,
right.
And then you had the haversack. So whenever you went on patrol, you either carried a 60 mortar round or a 3.5 round, or some guys carried a stick of C4. And then every other guy would carry either dead cord or time fuse. And then every guy carried a belt of machine gun ammo. And then you had your BAR guys out there, and then we had the flamethrowers. So So everybody out there was carrying weight. I mean, it was, you were weighted down. And when I was out there, it was toward the summer. It was brutal. There were times I'll never forget this. I'm on an ambush one night, and we're all laying there. And the machine gunner was laying back behind the gun, and everybody, and he got to sleep most of the night. Everybody else stood watch. And the way it worked was, if you saw something, you woke up the gunner. So I'm laying behind the gun, looking out into the jungle, the wind's blowing, and I'm thinking I'm seeing stuff, which probably I didn't. But anyway, I hadn't been out there in Vietnam that long, and I got a little nervous, so I woke up the machine gunner. And he wasn't too happy that I woke him up. So he comes up, and I'm whispering to him. I said, there's something out there. I know it. I can hear it. So he's laying on the gun, listening, and he's looking out there. And then he reaches down, and he puts the gun from safe to fire. And he says to me, okay, you're good. And he lays back down. And I said, man, there's something out there. I know it. But we ended up pulling out of the ambush early in the morning so they wouldn't see us. And I guess he was right and I was wrong. There was nothing out there. But he was one of those seasoned guys that nothing but him. He was coming to the end of his tour. And that's what you had to do when you got out there. You got to latch on to a guy that knows what he's doing and observe what he's doing. And every guy's going to do stuff that's right and stuff that's wrong. You just got to be mature enough to figure out what these guys are doing that's right and that's going to help you get back. Because the other thing I learned in Vietnam is you can have all the training in the world. There was luck involved in it.
Right.
You know, when you're getting hit with arty rounds and mortar rounds and you just happen to make it out of that attack, it ain't something you did. It's just you were in the right place at the right time and you ended up making it out of there.
You know, it's interesting. I was listening to an interview that General Ray Smith did about Sergeant Major Canley. So Second Lieutenant Smith goes as the replacement company commander. He might have been a first lieutenant to take over Alpha 1-1 during the fight for Quay City. Right? Gunny Canley has been fighting the company for how many days? And in the interview, General Smith said, he said, well, what people don't know about John Canley is that he's a fatalist. He believed that if there was a piece of metal with your name on it, there was no way to avoid it. So the only thing you could do was do your job, and that's what he did. He wasn't afraid of dying. He had seen enough people get killed, and he had seen the randomness of the battlefield. And so he just set about doing his job the way a professional should do it. And, you know, there's a lot of guys who probably maybe would have done that or thought to do it, and they would have got killed simply because the God who governs the flight of metal through the air is a fickle son of a bitch. But, you know, the randomness is out there is amazing. Talk to me about... I'm curious about the terrain. You talked about the canopy as you're moving up and down mountains, but can you give us a picture? How big are they? Are they like the northern end of Camp Pendleton Mountains, up by Horno, up by Mateo? Are they the mountains out? Are they the mountains out in 29 Palms? How big are they?
Yeah, I mean some of them were, and they're covered with foliage, and sometimes you're breaking terrain where you're climbing the side of a mountain, and sometimes you're on a trail. You're walking a trail, where it's probably not a good thing, but, you know, when I got there, you know, they had this weird saying. They said, recon breaks trail. We walk trail because wherever the enemy is, we're going to grab him by his ass and hang on. And that's what our job is. Recon's going to run into the enemy, call Artie on him, or they're going to call us. And when we come, we're going to grab the enemy by the ass and hang on to him. Wherever he is where we want to be. And that was kind of a philosophy out there for a while.
So when did you initially joined Bravo 19 out in the Khe Sanh area? At what point did you go to Khon Tien, Tim?
I was at Dong Ha. And And this was June.
Okay.
June of 67. And there was this weird rumor going around Dong Ha. And it was that General Westmoreland was not happy with the Marine defense of Kantian at all. He thought that, well, the end state for Kantian was going to be a 350-man Arvin battalion assuming command of Kantian. That was the end state. So we had 800-900 Marines out there surrounding Kantian, and in order for the, we were setting the Arvins up for failure because they'd have to put 2.5 battalions out there to replace us. So I'm back at Dong Ha. 1-4 had already got hit up there at Kantian. They lost 44 dead and so many wounded.
Right. That anyway, was, and that was when they got surrounded and then overrun on May 8th or something like that, when the NVA.
They had a penetration up there.
Right.
So I'm back at Dong Ha, and I get put on this deck with an engineer deck, and they come in and they say, okay, get your gear, get it ready. You're going to be on a convoy. First thing in the morning, you guys are going up to Kantian, and again, I was a PFC, so whoever was in charge of us, you're going to report to this captain. So we go up there, and the mission was we had to pull the entire perimeter of Kantian in. I guess they found out the perimeter was too big, it was taking too many people to defend. So we went up there with engineer dead bulldozers and bulldozed all the frontline positions while positions behind us were being prepared, redug.
Right.
They were digging in the Antoses, the Quad 50s, the Duster, the Twin 40s, and the 106s. They were redoing all the positions, pulling everything in. So we were up there for about, I don't know, 20 days doing that, day and night. We had to restring the wire for the FPLs, and you really don't know where the machine guns are going to be. So we're stringing wire and redoing all the positions, and I'm up there kind of providing security for the engineer guys that are doing all that work. And as they're pushing the bunkers in, they got rats the size of dogs coming out. And we're up there trying to kill these rats. And then shortly after that, we relieved, I thought it was 3-9. I don't remember. It may have been 1-4. I don't remember who we relieved, but we relieved somebody up there, and we occupied Kantian. And the thing about Kantian was, if you look at a map, the only way to get into Kantian is you got to come out of Dong Ha, you got to head west on Highway 9, and then you got to turn into Cam Lo. And there's only one road going into the back of Kantian, so that's the only way you get there by ground. So you got to keep C3 and C2 open. You got to own them. C3 is Camlo Bridge. You got to own that, and then you got to own Washout Bridge, which is up by C2. You got to own that.
All right, now I want everybody to. So what Tim just said, if you go to map number 9. All the things he spoke about are there. You'll see the Dong Ha combat base. You'll see all the AOs, Scotland, Lancaster, Osceola, Kentucky, Napoleon. And you'll see all those. You'll see all these things that he's talking about. You'll see where Kantian is. You'll see the cleared area that was bulldozed by the engineers that starts north of Kantian. And so you'll see all that now. Keep going, Tim.
Get cleared by the bulldozer. That's the strip.
Right.
That's the Gulen strip. That didn't have anything to do with our moving the positions in.
Got it.
They dug this 600 yard wide strip from Kantian to Gulen, thinking it was going to stop the flow of supplies coming south. And boy, that was a failure.
was it completed by the time you got there in the summer? That strip, or were they still working on it?
I think they were still working on it. They had some of the towers up on it, but before you could occupy the towers, the goose burned them down.
What about, let's put towers up there. There's a good idea. Talk to us about just... Kantian is, what is it? It's, what, the place of angels? What is,
they referred to concierge as the barrel, the meat grinder, and the hill of angels. And when we took it over from the Army in February of 67, there was an A-team up there with some indigenous folks. I guess the Marines looked at it and decided that they would circle all three hills. There's like three little hills out there. And we circled them all, and that's what took so many people a man. And then when you look at that road going out the back of Cantier, down by the LZ and the 105 park,
right,
that leads down to C2.
Okay,
so
now
you've combat called back at C2, combat called back at C3, and then you're going to defend Cantier.
Okay, so just so everybody knows, if you look on map number 6, you'll see a picture of the Cantier fire base, and you'll see a schematic right next to it, and you can see exactly what Tim's talking about. You can see the 105 park or where they were. You can see the road. It's like 351 or something like that, Tim, I think is the number of it. But it,
561, I think, going up through there.
There you go.
And some others.
But you can see exactly. You can see the three. You can see the three hills that Tim's talking about, and the problem as it lays down on the ground. And then if you flip back to map number 9, you can see that there's Contien, there's C2, C2 Alpha, and you can see the places that you have to own if you're going to do business in Contien. Now, talk about the significance of Contien, Tim. It's the highest point in the region. Is that it?
You could overlook the DMZ. So, I mean, that's why the enemy wanted us out of there, and we had to stay there because we could control a lot from there. We were looking right into the DMZ. And, you're right off the DMZ. You know, a lot of times people would talk about Quezon, and they thought Quezon was right on the DMZ. Quezon wasn't on the DMZ. Quezon was way back.
Yeah, not even close.
See, Contien and Chulin, you're right on the DMZ. I mean, you sit there and look out, and you can see the DMZ. And then they built the trace to try to stop supplies, because there was a supply route coming down 561, I think it was, they were using. And, it worked for a little while, and then I don't know what happened after I left. But, Contien was just a tough place to be. It was tough, it was dirty, it was nasty, it was, it was tough. It was a tough place to be. Rain, your position would fill with water. Days were long, it never ended. And then every once in a while, they truck beer in. Everybody got two cans of Black Label, or Pabst, or Schlitz. And you'd get them, hopefully the truck would get there in the morning, and you'd dig a hole and bury your beer and put a little water on it to cool it. And then that night when it got dark, you'd dig it up and drink it, and it'd be room temperature.
Now, Tim, were you part of Operation Buffalo?
Yeah, I was up on Contien for Buffalo.
Talk to us about, all right, so you're part of that unit. Operation Buffalo is a movement to contact north into the DMZ that Alpha and Bravo 19 execute. And the single bloodiest day during the war in Vietnam is during Operation Buffalo. 86 Marines killed in action. The total number, 159 Marines killed in action, 345 wounded. That number looks small to me. And 1,290 NVA soldiers killed during Operation Buffalo. Talk to us about Operation Buffalo. There's so much that has been written about it. You can see a lot of it, interviews about it. Give us your perspective of Operation Buffalo.
Well, I know at that time I was on Contien. Bravo and Alpha went out and headed toward the market. And I'm thinking, was it 3-9? Somebody had just been out to the marketplace and didn't make a lot of contact. However, in the lead up to Buffalo, can remember.
No, I hate to interrupt you, but no, I don't really. It doesn't bother me. But the marketplace is north of Contien, yes?
Northeast of Tontien.
Got it.
It's right on. It's right on Highway 561. The old Highway 561.
Got it.
So out from Bravo Push. It was an ugly day. Fast. Bravo makes contact. Bravo gets caught in this triangular-shaped ambush, artillery, mortars. Alpha tries to go over and help them. Alpha gets cut off. In the meantime, I'm up on Contien because we have to leave somebody back, and we didn't want to lose Contien. So we got C3, C2, and we got the rest of Contien. We got Charlie and Delta up there. So immediately, they know that Alpha and Bravo are in big trouble. And now there isn't any calm. So they start getting Delta ready, and then as the battle rages on, a call comes in from Staff Sergeant Burns. And the conversation goes like, I'm the 6, I'm the 5, I'm this, everybody's dead, I need help, get it out here right now, I don't care if it's the United States Army, get me help, or none of us are going to make it out of here alive. He grabbed the group, it was him and a lieutenant, he gets a group of folks, and at the same time, Delta and platoon of Delta and Charlie, and I think the element that went out with Charlie, General Labuti was with him, Frank Labuti was in Charlie company.
Right.
General Labuti goes down with an element, and they start going down to relieve or try to help out or get the survivors from Bravo 19, and they're picking up bodies. And the bodies are stripped from the waist up because the enemy took their flash helmets and rifles. So the enemy had flamethrowers. So they light everything up with the flamethrowers, and the Marines, the survivors, are running through the elephant grass back toward Contien. So they're heading south. And the Marines are trying to decide who to shoot, because the Marines are coming through the elephant grass. Some of them had a flak, some of them had no flak, and the enemy is running through after them with a flak and a helmet. So it's kind of hard to distinguish
right.
who is who. But they eventually figured it out, and they were picking up the bodies, stacking them on tanks, and then one of the tanks got hit with a B-40 rocket. And then we hacked out an LZ, and they started medevacing folks. I don't think we got everybody back, because a round landed right in the middle of the company commander, the FO, and the FAC, and killed all of them. There was like 5 people in this one group. A round landed right in the middle of them. And some of the bodies we didn't get, I don't think, for a little while, because when they came back, they were black from the sun. And it takes a little while for that process to happen. But it was, without a doubt, the worst day. And I had a couple of buddies of mine that when they came back up on Contien, they were spent. They were done. It was one of those things where they would never forget that. And one of them was a guy by the name of Larry Nez. He was going to be a school teacher in Iowa. And he and I stayed in contact until he got cancer and eventually passed away. But he was one of the survivors. And then it was Burns, Richie, and a few others. But then, obviously, people rotated, some of the survivors rotated back to the States. But, it was a battle. But as bad as it was, there were other battles that were just as bad. I mean, Vietnam was a tough slog.
Well, and I'll tell you what.
Very tough.
There was no tougher slog than the fights around Contien in this period of time that we're talking about, Tim. Honestly, when it's jaw dropping when you look at Operation Prairie,
Prairie Kingfisher, we did Hickory 1, Hickory 2 up there.
Yeah, this is Operation Prairie 4, which is a sweep of the area southwest of Cantien. Okay, southwest. 505 NVA killed, 164 Marines killed, 1,240 Marines wounded. Now, that's some serious fucking shit. You know?
I mean, today, if that happened today, you'd have politicians shooting themselves.
Oh, my. No. Are you kidding me? They don't have the balls to shoot themselves. They'd find somebody to shoot, though. They'd be screaming and yelling. But, I mean, but that's why, to me, this discussion is so important because, you know, when you don't think that you can be a disciplined force, when you think that, oh, that's just chicken shit, and then you're going to go into somebody who's not going to blow up an ID and run away from you after they play the ROE game with you, they're going to close with you with a flamethrower. They're going to stick Bangalore torpedo in your razor wire, and they're going to come and kill your ass. We haven't fought somebody like that since 1967, 1968.
And you can't imagine the discipline and the moral and the physical courage that a kid had to have to make it out of Operation Buffalo or Hickory 1, Hickory 2, and go out on another one the following month, knowing half of your squad was killed in the last operation, and you're going out on another one. And this time, you went from being a rifleman to being a squad leader. I mean, you moved up that fast. I mean, it was another thing that happened when we moved the wire back in Cantien, we stopped using flamethrowers. So we emptied all the flamethrowers up there. We put the napalm in 55-gallon drums, and we buried it out in front of certain positions where we thought there was going to be a good chance of a penetration, and put a block of C4 under it and ran the wires back with a battery to a certain positions. And if we ever got penetrated, it was going to be a long day. I guess we were going to have shake and bake.
So now, how long
that
do you...
went out there, Mike, what's you that? Got surrounded. I don't care how big you were. Right. If you went out there as a battalion, the NVA would somehow muster a division and surround you. You went out there as a company, you always got surrounded, and the enemy reinforced quick. And that's what you know, I read these articles about Marines are in these firefights in Iraq, and there's like 12 guys out there. I mean, 12 enemy or 14 or 20 enemy. Well, picture a thousand of them coming at you. I mean, it's something that when you survive that, you take a certain amount of pride. I mean, and you have a sense of sadness for the guys that didn't, because guys that died out there died in a bad way. Some of the Marines that were dying on Operation Buffalo, when their bodies get back up on the hill, the ones that came back up on the hill and then got medevaced from there, some of them guys, they found their bodies in craters, sitting down with their weapon broken down in half with a cleaner rod in their hand, and they were shot 40 times. I mean, they were literally shot to pieces. I mean, you were fighting against an enemy that was absolutely ruthless. Ruthless. And in time, Marines got that way. I can remember being called in. I don't remember where we were, but everybody in the unit had to sign a page 11 entry concerning inhumane and humane treatment of foreign captives and foreign nationalists. Foreign nationalists and captives is the way it read. And they were cutting ears off. The Marines were chopping them up. I mean, it was just brutal. It was that kind of a war, and I think the longer you stay in a place like that, things can turn on you quick.
All right.
But the Marines up there, I'll tell you, them kids were fearless.
Hey, there is a picture at the very you'll see in the Adobe Acrobat file that has all the maps in it for this. The very last image is a picture of the bodies of Marines on the back of a tank. And I'm sure, Tim, you have this emblazed in your brain, but I mean, it's a sobering, sobering picture. And it's from July 2nd, dead Marines from Bravo 19 being taken out by tanks. It is a large pile of bodies of Marines on top of a tank that's moving back through the DMZ towards Kantian. And you look at that and it's sobering. That's why to me Kantian is such an important series of actions for Marines today to read about, right? Because if you want to talk about fighting somebody who will close with you, who is not afraid of you, right, and is looking for you to do something stupid or something that's not sound, and they're going to bust it off across your head, and they're going to kill everybody. Read about these battles, right, around Kantian that Tim has been so gracious to talk about. So, Tim, so Buffalo comes and goes. You've been in country for, what, about 6 months now?
And then you know, the operations continued. We went back to Kantian September, and it was like you were fighting over the same ground all the time.
Right.
But anyway, I stayed out there. We did a number of operations, and then
What was your billet? So you're still a PFC? You're still a rifleman? What are you doing? And had there been any changes made at that point to the M16, or were you still fighting with that pig too?
I think we still had the same rifle. Because they were coming up with another one. I don't remember.
Was there any way to make it? You know, normally Marines have ways of fixing things. You know, whether they're legal or not.
Rate of fire, it didn't have a forward assist.
Right.
And it had there was something about the chamber. There was a lot of chatter about the chamber on the weapon. It was either a chrome chamber or a steel chamber. There was something about the chamber. I don't remember. But, I don't remember.
Okay. I just wondered, you know, when you're getting ready for an inspection, I can remember being a second lieutenant in 1984 with Charlie 15, and we're doing our final weapons cleaning, right, for I don't know what kind of inspection we were standing before we deployed. And my staff sergeant says, "Hey, Lieutenant, you're going to need to stay away from here for the next few hours." I said, "Why is that?" He said, "I can't tell you. Just stay away from here. We got to make sure these weapons are clean." And so, you know what they were doing, right? They were everything that he needed and knew how to do to get weapons, you know, sparkling clean, so everybody's going to pass is going to get done. From break free to carburetor cleaner to taking them in the shower to everything that whether it was authorized or not. It didn't matter at that point. We were now getting to some serious stuff. I just wondered if you guys had found a workaround for the problems of the M16 as you all, I mean, shit, you're betting your life on that weapon. But it sounds like there wasn't any fix for it.
Nope. And then, let me tell you an interesting story that happened up at Dong Ha that has to do with bodies. I don't remember if it was Richie or somebody else walked in the tent. They were looking for somebody to go up to the Dong Ha Bridge and man a 50 caliber machine gun at night. So I volunteered. So I thought it was going to get me out of doing certain things because I'd come back in the daytime and sleep because I'd be up all night. Wrong answer. But anyway, so this commitment at the Dong Ha Bridge comes to an end. And now I'm on, standing turn of God out of Dong Ha. Waiting to go up to the barrel or the Hill of Angels. So anyway, I'm on permanent guard, and I had been up all day, been up all night the night before at the Dong Ha Bridge, and I close my eyes for a second, 1 second, and I get caught. So the Richie says to me, he says, "We're not going to give you office hours. What I'm going to do is I'm going to sign you to grade registration for 2 days over at Delta Med." And I said, anything's better than an office hours. I'll do it. So had no idea what I'd be doing. Early the next morning, they packed me up, put me in a Mighty Mite, and they drive me over to the Delta Med on the other side of the runway at Dong Ha. So I get over there, and I walk in, and there's bodies on stretchers in body bags lining the road, both sides of the road. And I still don't know what's going on. I walk in there. There's a Navy corpsman sitting behind a table with a typewriter, and he's white as a ghost. He has no color, no personality, no sense of humor, nothing. He's just sitting there working with these dead bodies. So I walk in, and there's sawhorses with two gigantic fans. So now I get my brief from this lieutenant. My job, along with the other guy that screwed up, was to go out there and get a body, pick up the stretcher, bring it in, set it on the horse. Once you get it on the horse, you got an apron and these rubber gloves. You pick the body up, you get it out of the body bag, and you lay it down on the stretcher. And our job is to wash them. You strip the guy down and you wash him. You wash all of these bodies. And then once you get them washed, then the Navy comes out and sets the body. You know, the arms are up, they're down, the legs are up, they get it all straight. You wrap it in a clear cloth, piece of cloth like a sheet, wrap it in clear plastic, and then you put it in another body bag and you put it out in a refrigerator truck. And then once you've got a certain amount of bodies in that truck had to leave because it had to go to Force Logistics Command for whatever they did to the bodies over there. But I'm cleaning bodies, Marines, gunshot wounds to the head like you would not believe. Chest, head. I mean, it really brought home, and I hadn't been out there that long, but it brought home the viciousness of the war. And there were all the bodies that were, you know, in pieces, and you had to be careful to preserve the ID tags on them. But I did that for 2 days, and let me tell you, I never once, whether it was Contien, whether it was GLN, whether it was Kason, I never once thought about sleeping on guard duty. Never. And that was a hell of a way to learn a valuable lesson about staying awake.
Yeah, see, I mean, that, you know, we do it now in onesies and twosies, Tim, right? And as you said, it makes national news when we lose a single person. And so this concept of peer war, that we would do it at that, and again, the discussion about discipline is perfectly timed almost for this discussion about peer war. If you think you're going to close with the Russians or the Chinese, locate, close with, and destroy them, you better have it strapped on, and you better be good, because when you're not, you're going to get your head kicked in.
Yeah, I think these kids today are good. I think the problem is I think we might be overly concerned, and this is me talking, overly concerned with their welfare. I think you can over – oh, God, I don't know. I try to be careful getting in – discussions about discipline, because I'm retired and I'm from an entirely different generation than these kids are. But what I worry about is one of these days we're going to cross a line of departure and we're going to hook up with somebody who has air capability, air, arty, mortars, and we're going to take some heavy, heavy casualties, and I don't know how this country's going to deal with it.
No, I agree with you, and that's why this discussion about discipline is important. And marrying up these two discussions about, let's look over the horizon, and let's just, and this is my opinion, this is why we're doing this. Let's look at the last time we as a Corps fought somebody. They weren't a peer, because they didn't attack us from the air. They were a near peer, and they were relentless, and they weren't afraid to die. And so, let's look at that, and that's what takes us to Contien. And when you look at that and say, okay, are we up to this?
Yeah, but you know this, yeah, you're right. But when you go back to Vietnam, there's an awful lot more than Contien. And then you got the incident you and I talked about, the Ghost Patrol.
Right.
I mean, that was a, and I joined that unit after that incident, and those Marines were, I'll tell you what, they didn't forget that.
Were you part of 126 when they went out and did the payback?
No, I got up there after that.
Okay, all right. Because
they but the payback lasted all the way down through Fubai, Fulak, all the way down to Haigon Pass. These so many shits were ruthless because you know they left an entire platoon out there for 30 days.
Right. No, and they when you hear them talking about you. You hear, have you seen that documentary Bravo that you and I were talking about?
No.
I'll send you the link. You hear these guys talking about knowing that their friends were out there and they couldn't get to them for 30 days. And they talk about they went outside the wire and they're at the line of departure and, Captain Pipes, who you know,
yeah.
Ken Pipes, who passed away a year ago, he gives the order over the radio, fix bayonets. And
yeah. The
squad leaders get the orders, you know, and they look at everybody and they said, fix bayonets. And everybody looks back and says, what? Fix bayonets. And then they talk about using flamethrowers in trench lines, NVA bodies, so that I never even touched the dirt when I walked through this trench. And I walked through it for a long ways, and the kind of fighting that went on during that fight, and it's amazing. And the other thing that you notice when you hear them talking about it is 50 years later when they're talking about this, right, because these interviews were just done within the last few years, 50 years later, it's as vivid for these guys as it was the day they did it. And you're sitting there watching going, holy shit. You never, ever get over this shit. You never leave it behind. It stays with you forever. And it's an amazing. So you join 126 when?
I joined 126 in 1968. They were closing Quezon down, coming out of Quezon, and we were going to the Fulak, Fubai, doing the bridge thing.
Right.
And down to the Haigon Pass.
Got it. Talk to us about, were you still fighting? Now, we're talking about post-Tet. Now, one of the interesting things I've read is that, you know, Tet really did impact Quezon or Con Tien because they had that level of fighting for so long that it wasn't like there was a spike in activity because that activity had been spiked for a long time. It affected a lot of the rest of the region and a lot of the rest of the country, but the places that you were, I mean, it was on from Jump Street. And so talk to us about, did the fighting change when you went through, you know, Fulak and down towards Fubai and whatnot?
No, because that was after Tet.
Right.
This was post-Tet.
Okay.
And all the fighting done down there was small skirmishes. I mean, we did, we made contact at a couple of bridges. We made contact at the top of Haigon Pass and the middle of Haigon Pass. And, Bravo and Charlie came down to Haigon Pass to Namo Bridge. And, we took the SO oil plant at the base of Haigon Pass. Charlie Company took Namo Bridge. And I don't remember where Alpha and Bravo was at that time, but it just went on, and it was you know routine patrols, saturation patrolling, ambushes at night, we didn't take a whole lot of casualties. We took a couple. We didn't take a whole lot of casualties from that time on. And then I finished that tour, came home, and I went to a Marine Corps loop over Rhode Island and then got out.
My guest today is retired Marine gunner Tim Galinas. And Tim, one of the things we talk about here on All Marine Radio is post-combat related mental health. The events that you participated in as an 18-year-old man were some of the most violent of the Vietnam War. How did it affect your life? How did you deal with it in the aftermath?
Well, to be completely honest with you, I was fortunate on Buffalo. I was up on Contien when Bravo and Alpha were in contact. Although there were other operations where I was, you know, directly involved. But for me, I don't know. Maybe it was because I was a zany guy before I even enlisted. So. I don't know. I'm fortunate. I think about Vietnam periodically. If I see something on the TV or if I read an article about it, I'll think about it, and I'll think about how I'm not so sure we get it yet. That one of these days we're going to hook up with somebody, and we better get ready, and we better get ready now. I think the training we do today is getting folks ready, but I think there's so much more, and I guess we'll talk about that later, to keep these guys sharp, you know?
Interesting. No, you that combination. I mean, hell, Tim, just the shit you told me about carrying, you know, the body of a staff sergeant, right, for a couple days, right, burying, right, cleaning bodies, right, and packing them up because you fell asleep on guard duty, and getting them ready to get sent back to the United States. Just those episodes in and of themselves are enough to crush people. And yet you seem to have, you know, come through it, and you say because you were already a zany guy, which I would take to mean you were already probably a tough kid. But still, even tough kids get buckled by stuff like that. So.
Oh yeah, I mean it's. I think I was fortunate. I can't put my finger on why I'm not drawing 100%.
Right.
Post-traumatic stress, I don't know. I'm 71 years old. Maybe it's because my head is empty. my been sucked out.
So when you to finish this up, and when you think about the lessons that you learned in those fights at Contien, at in and around Khe Sanh. What lessons, if you know, would you tell Marines leaders listening to this? What were the lessons as you kind of matured as a Marine and as a leader of Marine that you took from those experiences?
Know everything you can about your weapon system. Know how to employ it. Know when you're going to employ it. Pay attention. Keep your head in the game. And it's those attention to detail things. Don't get out on a patrol like I did on 861 to find out your E-tool is back at Khe Sanh. And we had to dig in quick. And I'm trying to dig in with a canteen cup and a K-bar. Pay attention. If you do use warning order patrol orders, pay attention to the gear list. Take what you need. And the biggest thing, and I'll go back to that, is know your weapon. Know everything there is to know about your weapon. Know how to use it. Know when to use it. Period. So that when you squeeze that trigger, somebody falls dead. Period. I mean, that's what you're out there for. And make sure, by the way, the right guy falls dead.
That's not a small detail. In fact, one of the things that they talk about at during one of those fights on Khe Sanh was kind of a little limited patrol that they did, and they took friendly fire and I don't know if the Marine actually was killed, but they talked about they were seeing tracers coming out of their own positions and couldn't believe it. Tim, first of all, thank you very much for doing this. I think that the battles that you fought in are really important for Marines to take a look at and begin to understand, if this is what's in the offing, if this is what we're gonna get, if this is what we're gonna turn to relative to training, right? Better learn from the past, right, and embrace those lessons so you don't have to repeat them, at the cost of dead Marines, because the numbers that we talk about when we look at casualty figures for the battles of 1967 and 1968 in and around Compiègne, in and around Leatherneck Square, and then extend that out to the Rock Pile and Caisson, I mean, you talk about a lot of Marines who died there, and we need to my point in doing all this is we need to go to learn those lessons and be smart for their sacrifice, and so the next time we close with somebody in a peer war, that we're ready to go.
I think the important lesson that I took out of Vietnam is I learned a lot about what my weapon and weapon systems in Vietnam. Don't wait till you cross the line of departure to learn. You better learn it right here, because it's too late.
Got it.
And I was fortunate enough. I learned, and then I made it back. I think there's other people out there that learned and didn't make it back.
No.
Learn before you go.
All right, sir. First of all, thank you very much for doing this and sharing your knowledge and your experience with us. Truly appreciate it, Tim. And look forward to talking with you about discipline and the things that you've learned over a career about discipline, and looking forward to that visit.
All right, thanks. See you later.
All right, there you have it. That is Gunnar Glenis here on All Marine Radio. More of this program coming up next. Don't touch that dial. Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network. The one and only. How about that? That's why I say I have the coolest job, to go from battlefield studies to post-traumatic winning to on discipline. It's taken me three years to get it here, but in fact, yeah, next week, June 1st, marks the end of 3 years of All Marine Radio into our fourth year. Three long-ass years, man. I ain't lying to you. No. Yeah, go ahead. Start a small business. No problem. But how cool was that? Seriously. Gunnar Glenn is talking about being a PFC. In the battlefield studies we've done, right, everybody's been a leader, right? I mean, the lowest person in terms of rank structure that we've had as part of battlefield study has been a squad leader. So life a little bit different through the eyes of a PFC when you're the one, right, on the medevac detail, when you're the one carrying somebody's body for a couple days, yeah, and then fall asleep on post, and what happens to you? So, how cool? I mean, that's awesome. I mean, I could sit there and literally listen to that stuff all day. Him talk, and then you see, I mean, it is, I don't know if it's fate or whatnot, but this talk of discipline, and you're going to close with somebody like that, right? You better have your shit together, man, because on successful operations, you're talking about killing 500 and some, I can't remember what was the number, 550 NVA soldiers, and you have 140 Marines killed. Yeah, that's some shit, man. That's some serious shit. So, no, my thanks to Tim Glenis, gunner type, United States Marine Corps, retired, now doing range stuff out at the Marine Corps Air Ground Combat Center, but awesome. Montana man. Glenis was his gunner at 1-7. And then they worked together in the S3 section of RCT-7 when Colonel Mattis was out there motivating everybody. Yeah. But no, just wonderful stuff. Wonderful stuff. And, a tough kid from Rhode Island. And again, at 18 years old in Vietnam, doing that. Cleaning bodies for 2 days. So, anyway. Have a great the rest of Tuesday. Just keep listening to this. Tomorrow, you're going to hear Lieutenant General Dennis Halick in the second installment of On Discipline. And so don't miss that. It's going to be cool. So have a great Tuesday. Remember, somehow or other, communicate to the people in your neighborhood that don't be afraid to fly the American flag. With its warts and all, on the worst day of this country, it is still the shining light of the world. Yeah, no kidding. With all of our warts, all of our stupidity, we're still the best thing on the planet. So have a great day. And reminder, if you haven't reached out to Gold Star families, you know, reach out to them. Make sure they know that you haven't forgotten. On a Tuesday, All Marine Radio, over and out.